Welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek Discovery podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, and I have the same haircut as Captain Picard.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and I failed the Kobayashi Maru. Could have been the 0% aggression.
And together, we run a speakeasy in the Jeffries tubes.
Today, we're talking about the third episode of Star Trek Discovery, Context is for Kings, which is a great title. I don't know if I love it as it appears in the episode, but I like it as a title.
I'm going to have a lot to say about the title. Context is for Kings was written by Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts and Craig Sweeney.
And it was directed by Akiva Goldsman.
So after the standalone movie prologue that was the two-part premiere, now we finally get an actual pilot for the show Discovery.
Standalone is the right choice of words there because we feel very far away from the pilot in a lot of literal and metaphorical ways.
Very far away indeed. Should we just jump straight into our recap so we can see exactly how far away from the battle at the binary stars we are?
Yeah, that seems like a good idea. Let's go.
Well, it's been 6 months since the battle at the binary stars, and Michael Burnham is being transferred to Talun to work in a dilithium mine. And she's not the only one on board her shuttle. And the other prisoners think that her mutiny is responsible for the now raging war with the Klingons and the deaths of the 8,186 people who served on the Europa. And we're going to encounter this attitude again in this episode. But Valerie, it's my understanding Michael Burnham's mutiny did not start the war or cause the destruction of the Europa. So what do you think is going on here with this attitude?
I'm glad you brought this up. And I think I'm going to keep saying that throughout the podcast because this episode confused me. I will say that I'm walking out of this episode with a less than positive view of the show, and I'm a little nervous. I remain hopeful, but we'll see. So, and this was one thing that kind of bugged me because it didn't really make any sense. The only way I could logic it to making sense to me is that it's that she killed the Klingon on the beacon that makes the war her fault. Because I'm not sure if they ever, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure if they ever explicitly say that her mutiny started the war. They say, the war's your fault, and they say, you're a mutineer.
No, you're right. I guess nobody ever says that explicitly, actually. You're right. It is in some ways two separate attitudes. But I think I would quibble even with the idea that her killing the torchbearer, the first torchbearer, was what caused the war, right? I mean, the whole, like, T'Kuvma caused the war. The whole thing was a trap. The whole thing was a setup. And there was nothing that Michael Burnham was going to do or anyone else was going to do that would have prevented the war other than for the Federation to have not shown up, to have not taken the bait for the trap. And so, I was reading this as not a mistake that the writers made or like a misunderstanding of their own story, but showing us actually the way that news works in the Federation, that people know she went, she was on trial probably very publicly in some way, for this mutiny, and that this followed this horrific defeat, this military defeat at the Klingons, and that in people's minds the two things are related.
That was going to be my second guess, is if they didn't explicitly mean that the accidental murder. Can you have accidental murder?
That's called manslaughter, I think.
that her killing the Klingon, the torchbearer on the beacon, if that's not the explanation for this, then the only other explanation, has to be that the subtleties of, well, they were lured to a trap and it wouldn't have mattered anyway, and T'Kuvma didn't attack them for retribution. He just attacked them because that's what he was planning to do anyway, and there was nothing anyone could have done. And though the show implies, except actually maybe Michael's original plan of firing first, though I still think that wouldn't have done anything. T'Kuvma was pretty set on his plan. So I agree that it must just be, it's nice to have someone to blame when the world is falling apart around you and people are blaming her.
Yeah, and we're going to get some hints in this episode that the war might not be going so well, or certainly it's taken a lot of resources. People are not happy that they have to live a life at war now, and we're gonna get a couple good speeches about that.
And I'm definitely interested, in particular, on your perspective, having done some soldiering yourself, about what's going on and the attitudes on this new ship that we're on. But yeah, the main thing here is that the pilot really sets the story up, and I'm not confident that much of what happened in the pilot ever really comes to matter or anything at all. It was just like the information we needed to get here.
Yeah, it's true. I actually felt a little bit like the 3-minute summary that we got at the beginning of this episode was probably sufficient.
I was sad about that because I thought the pilot was really good in so many ways. I didn't see a lot of those ways carried over into this episode. It's not just that there was like a storytelling disconnect or some not all the characters made it through. It was like the spirit of the pilot and the service it paid to the Star Trek universe and its real attempts to fit in appropriately to it were amazing, and those were not, I don't think, carried over into this episode, and this episode is more indicative of probably what the show will become. So that's a huge part of my disappointment.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to seeing some specific places as we get through the recap here. Species GS-54 are tiny space bugs that feed on electricity, and right now, they are feeding on Burnham's prison shuttle. The pilot puts the shuttle on cruise control and steps out into space to kill the bugs, but she herself is killed as her tether snaps, and now the prisoners are trapped on a ship that they cannot control. So, Billy, what did you think of this scene?
It was intense, and it was dramatic, and it set a tone that ended up carrying throughout the rest of the show that I'm not sure that I'm super excited about. But there are a couple small things to notice. One is, what's up with the shuttle pilot's uniform? Like, she's like half of a stormtrooper or something. I found that very confusing. It didn't seem to fit with the world. Did you notice that?
Yeah, she had sort of a weird like breastplate on is what it looked like. And I assume that has something to do with being on the ship with a bunch of prisoners.
I guess we've already seen in the pilot, like, so much death, right? So much death in this series. So, like, for the first decision to be to just kill this pilot didn't really make sense to me either. Unless Michael was going to go out herself and save the day. Like, that's what I expected was going to happen, is after the pilot lost their tether, she would go out and she would fix it. But instead, they just get pulled in by a tractor beam, which would have happened whether or not the pilot died. So I don't know why that needed to happen. And also, the Shenzhou got saved by a tractor beam like 2 seconds ago. So I was a little bit like, okay, I saw this trick already. Is this just always going to be the trick? Is that we're in trouble at the last minute, tractor beam?
We also get here, Valerie, finally, something that I was clamoring for in the premiere, and that is an aerial, a beautiful aerial shot that introduces us to the ship that is going to be our home on this show.
Right, so this is the first place we meet the USS Discovery, which is also the first place we realize why the show is called what it is called. So that's helpful. Fills in some information gaps. Glenn, what did you think of the ship?
It looks very good. You know, I don't know anything about how effects are done, but these look very good to me. The ship itself looks very sleek. I was very interested to note, though, like this sort of gap in the saucer section where the sort of central area with the bridge only is connected to the outer part of the saucer section only by sort of 3 passageways. This strikes me as maybe not an actual like good engineering design, but it did look cool.
Yeah, I don't know if it's good engineering. You know, maybe it lets the wind through, the space wind.
Right. So one thing I was noticing about this design is that it permits for a lot more windows, but you actually can have a situation here where I think you could be in the sort of center bubble section looking out your window into another window on the interior of the ring section. And so I imagine this can set up some kind of like girl next door, boy next door, teen romance situations. So I'm looking forward to that episode, probably about season 5. It'll be their version of Lower Decks.
Oh my God. That is so not where I thought you were going. You went to a much more whimsical place. I was thinking as you said that, oh, the ship's a panopticon. Oh, which is like totally a different direction.
Yeah, I went more rom-com, but I think this is kind of just a metaphor for our personality types.
We are so far from the actual plot of the episode right now, which is usually my fault, so take us back.
On board the Discovery, Commander Landry, the chief of security, escorts the prisoners to the galley, and we get a tour of the corridors here. There's lots of silver uniforms, so lots of science officers, but also the security personnel have something we haven't ever seen before, a black Starfleet badge.
I wanted to point out that Commander Landry, first of all, is done serving her time on Battlestar Galactica. and also a Canadian actress of North Indian descent. So again, one of the things that I do have to say that's really positive continuing through this episode is they're still doing a great job representing diversity in this universe with their casting. And I'm really excited about that. So that's still in the plus column for me. And I think worth pointing out.
Yeah, and Commander Landry is real cool here, I think. I mean, like, literally cool. She has ice. She's ice cold. She has a little bit of anger, I think, at every person she speaks to who is not the captain of the ship. And I really like it. She's taken her job at security very seriously.
Did you get a little bit of sexual tension between her and Lorca in the last scene of the episode?
Sure did.
Okay, all right. Not just me. So yeah, Black Starfleet badge. That seems not cool.
It feels like evil Starfleet. Feels like evil Starfleet to me in some ways more than the mirror universe Starfleet does.
Again, this is gonna be one of my main criticisms and a big question I have for you later, so I'll save the question, but this ship is not, nobody's nice on this ship. And like, and it's uncomfortable and weird, and it doesn't feel like Star Trek to me, because Star Trek is very like positive and happy. So this is just like the first sign of that to me. And we're not in the mirror universe, though maybe we are.
Oh, that's okay. She's calling it now. So in the galley, Burnham encounters someone she knows. This is a woman named Kayla with some sort of Borg-looking head implant.
Yeah, she was the helmsman on the Shenzhou.
Oh, she was. She was.
Yeah, she's Jenny Weasley.
You know what? I didn't pick up on that at all. Okay, so interesting. So what do you think is going on with that head implant then? Is this something to do with an injury sustained in the Battle of the Binary Stars?
Oh, no. It's most certainly something to do with what's going on this ship. You know, we learn pretty soon here that the ship can handle 300 different discrete science projects at the same time. And it becomes clear quickly that they're not all legal or ethical experiments. And I think that she was part of that somehow.
Well, I'm looking forward to finding out what is up with her, but we don't spend any time with her at all in this scene before the other prisoners, who are now free of their shackles, decide to assault Burnham. She promptly dispatches them. Landry intervenes to take her to the captain. And they have a bit of a moment on a turbo lift here where Landry channels her inner Worf with a snide comment about Vulcan martial arts.
Yeah. I mean, it was cool to have some Vulcan martial arts named. So you said that the other prisoners go to attack her and she defends herself. They, like, sat up a little in their seats and then she, like, beat them all into the ground. That's how I read that.
Don't stand up around Michael Burnham. Everybody knows that.
Did you feel like, I felt like, one, it was a huge overreaction on the part of Michael. And two, that Landry's reaction of, like, put them in the brig and you come see the captain didn't make any sense. It seems like she should get in trouble for this. But anyway, Michael is going to see the captain because she punched real good.
On the Discovery Bridge, we discover that Saru is now the first officer of this ship. And Valerie, I have to say, I was really glad to see him.
Oh my gosh, me too. I was really sad that he wasn't the captain. But yeah, I was really glad to see him too. And I think that he's going to be an important character because he's not as evil as everyone else on this ship, but he's the first officer. So he's in a tough spot. He clearly cares about following the rules and being a good first officer, but he's having some moral conflicts that you can kind of see. I'm excited he's here. He's gonna give a lot to the show, I think.
I'm not even certain of the extent to which he knows what is going on the ship, actually, because he seems so innocent and so almost naive or good-hearted that he's going to be a good foil. He is definitely going to be put into a difficult ethical situation at some point and perhaps actually faced in some ways with the same choices that Michael Burnham was faced with in the prologue.
Well, that would be interesting if it helps them come together and be best friends again, which is clearly what we all want.
That is exactly what we all want. But here, Valerie, now we're going to meet the captain. In his ready room, Captain Gabriel Lorca is hanging out in the dark with a tribble and a bowl of fortune cookies. And it's totally not weird.
Yeah, what? Like,
yeah, it's totally weird.
I was so distracted by the fortune cookies that I didn't even notice the tribble until really late in the episode. Like the last scene where Michael's back in the ready room with him. Really interesting desk decorating choices here. And, you know, we get this, there's a little bit of comic relief here where Lorca is like, oh, I have a battle injury. I have to adjust to light slowly. Like, it seemed, you know, it's intimidating, isn't it? And Michael does nothing. And he's like, no? Huh. He breaks character for a second and is a little bit more lighthearted.
here's where we get Burnham leveling this charge at Captain Lorca that he has engineered her arrival on Discovery. Lorca dismisses her accusation and explains that while she is stuck on board for a few days, he's going to put her to work on some quantum physics problem.
Michael's smart. We get that. That seems to be a theme of the episode. But other than the fortune cookies, Glenn, what are your impressions of Lorca so far from this scene?
Jason Isaacs is a fantastic actor. He is exuding the sort of creepiness that got him the role of Lucius Malfoy.
I know, right? I thought he was such a weird Star Trek casting choice, and now I'm like, oh, I get it. He's still Lucius Malfoy.
Yeah, he really is, and it is very creepy. It's very sinister, and this is the first time we have met the captain of our ship or space station where our show is taking place, and we're not sure he's a good guy.
What do you make of that? What do you make of a Star Trek captain? Now, I know he's not going to be our main character, right? So there's a little bit of a shift there. We have lower ranking officers, or not officers at all, prisoners, as our main character here. But what do you make of having a captain who we're not sure is a good guy?
So I think it's a really great idea for a story. I'm not sure how Star Trek it feels, but maybe that's okay. But I do think it's a great idea for a story where we already feel that at some point there is going to be a moment when Saru has to make a tough choice here. You know, when he realizes just how not good, how sinister his captain is. I think we can feel that coming, that Burnham is going to have a part to play in that. We can see already that some of the other characters we meet do not like Captain Lorca either, but he has a real close relationship with Commander Landry and the people who hold the guns on the ship.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you said something there that is my main critique of the episode, which is I'm not sure how Star Trek it feels. And we'll get back to that later, but I would agree.
All right, well, let's move on to the next scene, and we'll come back to this topic of Captain Lorca once we get to see a little bit more of him. So in her new quarters, Michael Burnham meets her roommate, Cadet Sylvia Tilly, who talks a lot.
Aw, she's cute. She's cute. She's funny. I laugh.
She's adorable.
Evil ship. Weird things. It was nice to laugh for a second, and she is really just a ball of sunshine. And she doesn't feel like anyone that would be on a ship from Star Trek series past, but she feels like the kind of character we really like to see nowadays, so I'm excited about it.
She's a real nice contrast to the sort of seething darkness of Captain Lorca. She's going to be a bright spot on the show, I think, and she's going to be a character whose innocence and perhaps maybe even joy and enthusiasm we can latch onto as an audience, and I think that's going to really help us.
I hope it doesn't turn out that she's secretly evil.
So their conversation is interrupted by a black alert, which is a thing that is new for this show. Small blue particles appear in the room and then sort of disappear. And Tilly seems really afraid at this, and she will not tell Burnham what's going on.
Yeah, she seems extremely uncomfortable. It's like suddenly the ship reminded her where she is, you know, that this was her assignment, and she's in this world that is upsetting to her and difficult for her to process, and she just kind of shuts down.
Yeah, she's sort of huddled up on the bed, you know, almost in terror, like a little kid, you know, hiding from the boogeyman. And it was very cool. It really added some tension to this scene and definitely made me want to find out what the hell is going on, just like Burnham.
And we do find out, right, that it's water. That's what that stuff was. But we'll get to that when we get to that.
In the next scene, Saru escorts Burnham to the engineering lab where she will be working. They share some blueberries and Burnham tries to apologize, but she can't actually say the words. Saru accepts her apology, but still thinks that she is dangerous, someone to fear.
This was a really beautiful scene, this walking scene through the corridors into the lab. It was really touching to see Saru struggling with how much he cares about Michael and how he blames her still for Georgiou's death. He mentions, you know, the funeral. She mentions the funeral, actually, that she'd seen a recording of his speech at the captain's funeral. And you can see that on one level, he's really touched that Michael cares and wants to grieve with her and instead of alone or separate from her, but then is still in a conflict of feeling like it is her fault. So he's being harsh and sassy, but he clearly doesn't like it. And I do think maybe it's worth pointing out that the blueberry comment that you said, they share some blueberries and Michael makes a comment, these don't taste as good as the ones in prison. And he says, maybe that's something more to do with the environment you're eating them in rather than like the food replicator having some sort of malfunction. And this is our first kind of context is for King's metaphor or mention that's happening in this episode that we'll circle back at the end.
That's a really great observation. And blueberries themselves as this sort of like joyous, delicious thing to eat that just kind of exudes its own sort of sweetness, you know, and innocence and almost like childishness here in this scene on board a ship where we are already know that a lot of dark things, or at least already sense that a lot of dark things are happening, really suggests that their relationship, their friendship is going to be in some ways the blueberries in prison.
Glenn, I have never in my life thought so much about blueberries. You really like blueberries. That was really intense what you had to say about them there.
Well, let's move on from the blueberries then. In the engineering lab, no one wants to talk to Burnham, and Lieutenant Paul Stamets does not want her there. He's covered in sparkle dust, and we're meant to suspect that he has something to do with the Black Alert. Valerie, there's also an important conversation here about identity that really bothered me. Stamets says that he thought Burnham was a Vulcan, but he's looking at her now, and she's a human. And when Burnham explains that she was raised and educated on Vulcan, Stamets snaps back by comparing her to his uncle who plays in a Beatles cover band. And he says, that doesn't make him one of the Beatles, and so by extension, being raised on Vulcan doesn't make you Vulcan.
Interesting analogy here that he's using. I think it serves to demonstrate that I'm not know how much I like him, because it seems like a really offensive thing to say in such a cavalier manner. And what I thought was really interesting about this scene is that there's a little bit left in Burnham where she wants to argue, to say, like, that's really offensive. That's not how that works. Don't say that stuff to me. But eventually she just kind of acquiesces. I think there's a point where she says, well, no. Okay, I guess kind of. And I think that okay, I guess kind of is just a sign of her depression, of where she's at, of how far she's fallen, that she's not even going to argue these points that, as we saw in the scene with Admiral Anderson in the second episode, are really important for her to call out and say something about and not just let pass in front of her. But here she kind of just lets it go.
That is an amazing observation, Valerie. I was so focused on Stamets and his anger in saying these lines. I wonder, why is he so angry about whether or not Burnham is culturally Vulcan and biologically human? He seems very angry about that. And I was so I was focused on that. But I think you point to something really great here, which is that this is clear evidence that Burnham is just maybe kind of giving up. And maybe even she's giving up on defending her own identity.
And it's also, it serves to remind us that, you know, these comments on race and culture that were only a small part of the pilots and of what we saw about Burnham enduring in the first two episodes are actually just embedded in her daily experiences, that people are constantly pointing this out to her and she is constantly having to deal with these offensive comments. And sometimes she has the strength to respond to them in a certain way, and sometimes she just can't. And I think that maps onto a lot of people's real lived experiences with these kind of aggressions towards their identity. So I still think that that's a really interesting thing. I wonder, if you were more focused on Stamets's anger here, what did you make of that?
I had a few observations about Stamets, or at least a few thoughts about Stamets. One, you know, the anger. What he's angry. We're going to come to find out that he is angry about being on board this ship to begin with. So I think everything that he does is infused with this anger. But I also think here we're going to come to find out that he is a biologist. And so I think perhaps we're being shown something about the way that he views the world, that that the biology is more important for him than the culture, that her species is, for him, is her identity, and that culture is irrelevant and perhaps ephemeral to him. Perhaps I'm being charitable. He might just be a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that indicates that he's a jerk, or at least that he's a jerk right now. I'd agree with you from what we learn about why he's angry to be there at all, that it would make sense that he's just taking that anger out on everyone, and especially on someone over whom he feels he has authority and control and power. You know, that's how these things work. But he's not so good with the humans. He's better with the science, I think maybe is what you're saying.
And we're about to see that happen again here later in this scene. Stamets puts her to work checking data, and she stays late and overhears a conversation between Stamets and another scientist who is aboard the nearby USS Glenn. And they're working on the same science problem, though we as the audience don't yet know what it is. And the Glenn scientist says cryptically, there are unexpected benefits to not growing your own. And Stamets then says that what the Glenn is about to do isn't safe.
But what I really want to know here is, how do you feel about having a ship named after you, finally?
Yeah, that was, so yes, my absolute first thought was to figure out what the registry number is and then get it tattooed on me.
I'm waiting to meet the USS Valerie. That's all I'm saying.
And we'll have to, well, we're going to get over to the USS Glenn here in a minute. I'll actually bring this back as a point of comparison. We can talk about what your Starfleet vessel would be like as opposed to mine.
Mine does not have monsters on it, just puppies.
Right. But also in this scene, Valerie, we and Burnham learn that there is a breath lock to get into a secret room in the science lab. And so there's a lot of sinister stuff going on here, even just in the science lab. And Burnham, of course, wants to get in that room. She needs to get in that room. We don't even see her wrestle with a decision of any sort. We just see her go into action. She steals some drool from her sleeping and snoring roommate and then uses it to trick the lock. And inside, it's something of a space greenhouse with lots of plants and the particles that we've seen floating around. And when we see this wide-angled shot here of this greenhouse, Valerie, my first thought was, holy cow, is this the Genesis Project from Wrath of Khan?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, why don't you fill listeners in on that a little bit?
The Genesis Project from Star Trek to the Wrath of Khan is a scientific endeavor to find a way to create life out of nothing, to take matter that is not alive and to make life out of it. It's a secret science experiment that the Federation is working on in that movie that gets co-opted by the movie's villain to be used as a weapon.
Yeah, that's a really interesting catch, Glenn, though I think that, you know, something more sinister or more complex is going on here than being concerned with creating life on new planets and terraforming while they're at war with the Klingons. But yeah, it definitely has that visual language that almost begs you to think about Genesis.
I was very excited to see it, and we're going to find out a little bit more about what is going on in the secret science room here towards the end of the episode. In our next scene, we jump forward in time a little bit, and Captain Lorca announces to the ship that the entire crew of the USS Glenn has been lost while performing Black Alert maneuvers, and Stamets wants to know if it was because of a bloom failure.
I have a question here about Black Alert maneuvers. I kind of don't know what that means. I was confused by it when they said it in the show, because to me, Black Alert is just a thing that occasionally happens for a few seconds, right? That's all I know about it. I didn't know it was associated with any maneuvers. Do you have a reading of this?
An alert is a condition that persists on a ship that indicates to the crew how they're supposed to be behaving, how they're supposed to be operating at their duty stations. We're most familiar, of course, with red alert, which we see in crisis situations like, you know, shooting at other spaceships. But there's yellow alert condition, which will change up the way people are meant to be doing their jobs or what jobs they're meant to be doing. The black alert is going to be another one of those. And so they could be flying under black alert conditions for days at a time, for a week at a time. So it is true that we have only seen it here as this one little moment that seems to have something to do with something going wrong. And the alert only does last, you know, last less than a minute. But I think that whenever they're doing something with this particular experiment, they're going to go into a condition that is black alert so that people have their assigned roles while they're doing this. And so I suspect that that's what's going on with the USS Glenn, is that they were doing their experiment with whatever is happening here in the secret science room, something to do with a bloom failure, something that Stamets knew was very dangerous to do. And so they were on black alert while they were doing that, and they were performing maneuvers in order to test whatever it is they're working on.
Okay, that was extremely helpful. Thank you so much for getting into that for me and for listeners. I really appreciate it.
So at this point, Lorca explains that Stamets is going to have to take a crew to the USS Glenn to recover the top secret science stuff, and that Michael Burnham is going with him.
This is where we get, we see Saru's first conflict with the captain, where the captain asks Saru, well, what do you think of her abilities? And he, you know, he does this little, like, head flip that's like, I don't want to answer this question because I think she's dangerous and I don't want her around, but I have to be honest here. And that's, we're learning too, that Saru will be honest even when it's difficult to do that, or when his emotions, you know, are interfering in a way, he still can remain science officer enough and give the facts of the matter, which tells us something of his character. And he says, you know, she's the smartest Starfleet officer I've ever known. And I appreciated the oh, huh, and she's known you, that Lorca gives to Stamets there. It was funny. I thought it was well-timed.
Yeah, it was funny and well-timed, and I do think that we definitely see Captain Lorca here as a guy who really does not at all care about the feelings of the people in his care, the people in his charge. Very different from Captain Kirk, Captain Picard, really any of the captains we've seen so far, that these people aren't even people to him. They are simply tools for him to perform his job.
To that point, we glossed over something that really struck me that he said it in the ready room scene where we first meet him, which is that it was something to the effect of, I will recruit you or anything or anyone necessary under any circumstances by any means in order to achieve what I need to achieve. But basically he says, I don't care who or what or how. If I think I need it, I'm going to take it. And it is not how the principles of Starfleet operate, right? Because if that were true, then Michael would have been rewarded for her mutiny, which is actually something that Lorca suggests later should have happened. He's not the nicest. Is this also the scene where we get the this isn't a democracy line?
Yes, that's right.
That really stuck out to me when Stamets is complaining about not wanting to go to the Glen, thinking it's dangerous, you know, wanting to be able to pick his own team for it, not wanting to take Michael. And Lorca shouts at him, this isn't a democracy. And I understand that Starfleet isn't a democracy. There's a clear hierarchy. But it actually kind of made me wonder, what is the government of the Federation?
This is a great question, and I wonder if we'll get more of that in Star Trek Discovery. But it is something of a representative deliberative body. There is a Federation Council that has representatives from each of the member planets. This is actually what I think, anyway. I mean, there's debate about this, but my reading of the literature is that this is what Sarek is as an ambassador. Ambassador Sarek means that he is basically the senator from Vulcan, is maybe how we would understand that in American terms. And there is, we've seen several incarnations of a Federation president in Star Trek. It's unclear how that president is chosen. That we do not know. But so we don't, it's not actually clear to what extent there is democracy at all in the Federation. We do not know.
I understand that the chain of command is very important, but this line, this isn't a democracy, you know, shut up, stop arguing with me, just felt so out of place to me in the Star Trek universe.
That's very interesting. To me, having military experience, I didn't even really notice that line. I did notice sort of the tone with which Lorca delivered that line and that whole interaction with Stamets, but I've heard that line before. I've said that line before. And in some ways, I think to me, it's always been delivered to me, and when I have used it with soldiers in my care, it is about reminding them that perhaps your childhood was spent in a nice, free civilian democracy, but that is not what the military is. You don't have any rights here, and you have to do what I say. You signed up for this, is what that means. And it always is used, actually, as a contrast to say that your life as a civilian is over. You're not a civilian anymore. And while perhaps we might be here to make sure, we might exist, the military might exist to make sure that our loved ones back home can live that way, the price is that we don't get to.
That's the military. That's not, I know Starfleet is, it borrows a lot from military and is structured like it, and that's the best real world correlation we have for it. But I don't think of Starfleet as that militaristic in that sense. And I think what's going on in this ship feels so much like present day military and what those dynamics might be, with a harshness and a suspicion of people and a lack of understanding in the sense that, like, I don't care, just do what I say, that doesn't map on to what I know of Starfleet. And we get back to this question of, are we soldiers? Are we explorers? Are we diplomats? And on this ship, we're soldiers. We are soldiers so much more than on any other ship we have seen in the Star Trek universe. Forget explorers, forget diplomats. That's not what's happening here.
And that point is even underscored here by the very fact that Discovery is the premier science vessel of Starfleet, and we are seeing it be the most militaristic that we've ever seen Starfleet be. So there's a real militarization here of even kind of the core premise of Star Trek.
I take issue with it.
I do as well. We talked in the premiere about Star Trek's roots in opposition to the Vietnam War. And I think here, I don't think this is meant to be glorifying militarization or glorifying war. And I think that this is showing, this is presenting this to us as a theme. It was raised in the premiere. We're getting it now. It's being shown to us here. And I think that we're going to, this is what we're pointing to with Saru as being a contrast to Lorca. And we are going to see the contrast of these ideals here, I think, throughout the first season of Star Trek Discovery. And I'm looking forward to seeing how they deal with it.
I hope they deal with it. I'm a little bit worried we're just going to have a military space drama on our hands here. I'm a little bit worried, I think, that we're going to have some sort of military show or prison breaky show drama that just happens to take place in a Star Trek universe with Starfleet officers more than we're going to have a Star Trek show. That's my main concern here.
Well, we're gonna get some more of this here in the next scene, Valerie, when we get to learn about Stamets and his backstory that I think is going to be really relevant to this conversation. So let's dig in on that scene and bring that into the conversation.
Yeah, please, let's.
So in the next scene, Burnham, Stamets, Tilly, the security chief Landry, and some anonymous coppersides take a shuttle over to the USS Glenn. And on the shuttle, Burnham tries to figure out what the project is. She's concerned that the project is biology and not physics. Stamets, again, very belligerently, explains that at the quantum level, there's really no difference between biology and physics. And here he launches into an angry monologue that gives us his backstory. And that backstory is this. He's an astromycologist. He and the scientist on the Glenn had been civilians working on a project that would figure out the fabric of the universe. But then the war started, and they and their work were nationalized and put to use for Starfleet. And now his friend is dead, and Stamets hates that he is working for that warmonger Lorca.
One thing I was really affected by in the scenes where it's announced that something went wrong in the Glenn and the crew is dead, and also in this scene, is, Stamets keeps saying he's really upset that his best friend is dead, but it doesn't feel like that. Now, I know everybody, processes grief differently, and his is through anger, but he was pretty angry even before that. So I wanted a little bit more, this time with feeling from him. But, maybe that's too much of an ask, but it's just something that he felt a little disconnected, detached from what was happening, and maybe that's just his coping mechanism. But I was longing for him to have a tender moment, for this to end in an emotional outburst where we saw a little bit of what was beneath the surface with him. But also, I was really preoccupied in this scene when he's like, well, at the quantum level, biology and physics are the same. I was like, I got nothing. I wanted to be like, is that true? We should probably talk on the podcast about whether or not that's true, but neither of us are qualified to do that. So if anyone listening is qualified to say whether or not this Trekno-babble, whether or not this Trekno-babble is real or accurate, please let us know.
Yeah, drop us a note on the forums. I would love to know this too, that we're going to get some more science stuff at the end. I have questions. I was in some ways at that last scene even confused about what's going on. We'll get there eventually. But yeah, you and I, Valerie, very well qualified to talk about race and culture, issues of identity, literary analysis, historical scholarship, but not so much on the science.
It was also, it felt a little bit interesting to me too that they would have this character do that because a small portion of the viewers could possibly understand whether or not what he's saying is accurate. So for it to be just like his driving, frustration as a character felt a little bit unrelatable. He just kind of comes off as crazy science guy. But I will say that there's been some really fun Trekno babble in this episode. That was one thing I thought they did really well. I think it's in this scene that Stamets uses a word, and instead of it being, you're like, oh, that's just technobabble, and you know they make up words all the time, and that's part of this universe. She's like, wait, what's that word?
Yes.
And I thought that was kind of funny. They were poking fun a little bit at the science language of the Star Trek universe, and I really enjoyed that.
Yes, that's right. And I really love that she used etymology to try to suss out what this compound word actually meant. This is, you know, what I spend about half of my classes doing with my students. So we arrive now at the USS Glenn, which is essentially a haunted house. The lights don't work. There are corpses everywhere, twisted into impossible shapes. Someone or something is on board with them, and they find a dozen dead Klingons who had come to investigate for themselves. This amused me, Valerie, as you pointed out that the ship and I bear the same name. And as someone who writes weird fiction, who writes scary stories, I was happy to see that my ship is indeed a haunted house.
I'm sorry, you are happy about the fact that your namesake ship is like home to some of the most terrifying corpses I've ever seen? Yeah, just the aesthetic of this really was terrifying. So again, they're doing a great job with the makeup, with the special effects, because these are not, you know, CGI bodies. Someone has put care into molding these grotesque figures, and they've done it very, very well. I'm also very appreciative of that particular fact that they're like handmade, I guess. It's a creepy thing to say about corpses, but they scared me. I didn't like it. I don't want to be on the Glenn.
Yeah, it was real creepy, and of course it's about to get worse. All of a sudden, there's a monster, a big monster, and they have to flee to engineering. And during their flight, we lose our first Copperside.
Was he a Copperside?
He was, yes.
Okay, that's really interesting because I was so proud too. Again, I was watching this with the noob, and the noob turned to me and went, "Red shirt," and I was like, "Yes." you've learned, you can learn. And it was a proud moment for me because that's exactly what I thought, you know, it's like, there goes our first red shirt. Yeah, I think there are two things that you didn't touch on that I wanted to bring up in this scene. One is just creepy, and then one is I think going to be more important. So there's this scene where they're walking around the haunted house and there's a door that's trying to close, but it can't because there's a disembodied foot in the way. And so it keeps closing, opening on this foot. Then, I don't know if this was intentional, but it's something that caught me and affected me. When they're running away from the monster and their flashlights, and the scene is really dark, and their flashlights are moving up and down as they run and shining light on just certain things. One of the main things that we see is that part of the body of the people running. It's like the calf and the foot. And the effect of having seen that disembodied foot and then just seeing that part of these officers running away from the monster was really terrifying to me, and I thought kind of beautiful. I don't know if you noticed that. I might just be, you know, really zeroing in on something that wasn't intentional, but to me it was kind of powerful.
No, that I did. I hadn't noticed that. I think that's a fantastic observation.
The other thing is that we get this really awesome moment where we see that the monster is there because there is a Klingon alive on the ship. So they hear the Klingon, and the Klingon gets taken down by the monster. But right before we see the Klingon, Tilly, having heard a noise that I didn't hear, and it seems like the rest of the away team wasn't really aware of, turns around and in a very authoritative and serious and commandy voice says, "You in the shadows, show yourself." And it was like, whoa, that came out of Tilly. It was a character shift that we could see that she might be warm and bubbly and awkward, but she's serious business. And also she's really good at what she does. And it was a really subtle scene, but it really ties into, you know, later she's going to say she wants her own command eventually. And had that scene not happened, I don't know if I would have believed it. But we're being asked to confront what our assumptions might be about her capabilities by seeing her really take control forcefully in this scene.
It's really powerful. And I love this line that we're going to get later, sort of one of the last scenes of the episode when she says, "People don't know this about me, but I'm going to be a captain someday." And you're right. We do see that here. This is a great pickup, Valerie. I think we are seeing some really complex and complicated and I think deeply functioning characters here. And I'm excited about this.
No Harry Kims.
I'm certain that Cadet Tilly will get a promotion at some point.
Yeah, I hope so. As I don't like the other people in command right now.
Well, in the engineering lab, they work quickly to get the science stuff ready to go, even as the monster begins to break down the door. And when the monster breaks through, Burnham gets it to chase her into a Jeffries tube. And I was thrilled to see the first use of the Jeffries tube here in Star Trek Discovery. And as she's crawling through the Jeffries tube, she recites a passage from Alice in Wonderland to herself while the monster is chasing her. And then she very cleverly arranges a pickup by the Discovery shuttle. She drops through a hatch into the Discovery shuttle, and they all take off with the science stuff and without the monster.
Yeah, quoting Lewis Carroll out loud to yourself while you're alone is a totally normal thing to do.
It seemed to me that she was using it almost as a meditation technique, as a way of focusing her mind in order to suppress the fear and anxiety that she's feeling, that this is part of her Vulcan identity expressing itself.
I mean, that's a very generous reading.
Yeah, I'm going to have some more things to say about Alice in Wonderland when we get there in a few scenes, when this comes back in a few scenes. So back on board the Discovery on the bridge, Saru expresses regret that Burnham made such a terrible choice on the Shenzhou and that Starfleet has lost a valuable asset. But Captain Lorca sees the situation differently. In his ready room, he invites Burnham to stay and to work aboard the Discovery. And here, now, Burnham repeats her assertion that Lorca brought her here on purpose, probably because he wants her to work on some sort of biological weapons, which, of course, are illegal.
A large part of her response here, too, it's interesting that it's she does mention that she's not ethically okay with this and she doesn't want to do it, but also she just wants to go serve her time. You know, she is using her sentence as penance. She believes that she needs to serve that time to make up for the harm that she has caused, and that if she's not paying back that debt, then she can't really move on mentally from what she's done. So she has a lot of very complex reasons for turning down this job offer.
We saw in the premiere, you and I anyway, interpreted in the premiere, that the moment that she realizes that this mutiny was a mistake and that she, the realization, the full emotional realization that she has betrayed her friend, Captain Georgiou, hits her, that she seems to us to have gotten a little suicidal. She volunteered to deliver the weapon to Takuvma's ship and to go after Takuvma herself. And we've just seen her do essentially the same thing aboard the Glenn, where she volunteers to be the monster bait. Then we also learned at the beginning of this episode in the scene on the prison shuttle that dilithium mining is actually very often fatal for the miners, that there are tons of accidents that happen and people die. And it feels here like that's what she wants, that she's almost hoping that she will get to these dilithium mines and die in a horrible accident, that she's not going to take her own life, but she wants to put herself in a situation where fate will do that for her.
Almost as if, too, that she feels, not only does she feel so emotionally detached from everything, that she just can't find it in herself to care about her own well-being, she doesn't think that she deserves to be around. She doesn't think that her well-being is worth caring about. And you also see this on the prison shuttle in the beginning of the episode, really starkly contrasted with the fact that when the pilot of the shuttle dies, everyone else, all the other prisoners, start freaking out that they're going to die too, and she just sits there. She doesn't seem to care that that's the fate she's about to suffer. So that really ties in with what you said.
Yeah, that's another great pickup there, Valerie. So Lorca takes her to the secret science room to show her how very wrong she is about her assumptions. And he locks her in a clean room and then loads it up with mycelium spores and then gives us what really, to me, Valerie, felt like a villainous monologue. And the story is this. He's not working on a weapon, but rather on an organic propulsion system. They haven't had much success. But before everyone died, the Glenn had been able to use this organic propulsion system to go 90 light years in just 1.3 seconds. And it's not at all clear how this works to me, Valerie, but he's going to give Burnham a demonstration here. And so he fires up the system. And this was as a place where I had a lot of confusion. I'm hoping you did not. He fires up the system and uses it to send her to other planets for a few seconds. Is that what's going on?
No, I think he uses it. I think there's a green screen behind her on the ship, and it's special effects. No, I wish I had an explanation here for you. I don't understand how the spore-based roadways work. it was confusing to me as well. I also don't know exactly that makes these special effects happen. So I'm also really confused. I will say that it, I don't know how it happened or what was actually happening, but it did remind me of the original series episode, The City on the Edge of Forever, which is where the crew finds a circular structure on a planet that is basically like a window where that you just, you walk through and you're straight, you're in another place immediately. And like, you can see on the, like the viewer in between the circle, like what you're stepping into. And it kind of, it's like a screensaver or something that keeps rotating through places. So that's what it reminded me of visually, but I don't know what's happening.
So this is a place where I really want to encourage listeners to jump on over to our forums and let us know how they read this scene, because yeah, it was very confusing for me and I'm not quite sure what to make of it. You know, it doesn't perhaps matter all that much in this particular moment. That was, we move here pretty quickly to Lorca finally admitting that he did in fact arrange all of this. He did choose Burnham, but not for the reasons she thinks. The way he sees it, she was right about the Klingons and chose to do the right thing, even though it was illegal. Universal law is for lackeys, he says, but context is for kings. And he offers her a shot at redemption and a chance to win the war that killed her friend, Captain Georgiou. And Valerie, you've already pointed out something here that had not occurred to me while watching this. And Lorca uses the word redemption and he uses the word atonement here. And this is in some sense what he is offering her. Put your skills to use. Do something good with your skills. Don't just go sit in a dilithium mine, and certainly don't just go get yourself killed in a dilithium mine. And I think we're seeing here, as you've pointed out, Valerie, a contrast between prison as punishment versus prison as redemption or atonement. And she just wants to be punished.
I think something else is going on here that is really striking. Michael says, hey, you want me to do evil biological weapons thing. Also, we didn't mention it, but super cool thing, the Geneva Convention of 2155. That was a fun history fact. I liked that they threw that in. It really gave us some more facts to go put on like Memory Alpha or something on the internet. But she says, I'm not going to do this unethical thing that you brought me here for. He says, no, I'm not here to make you do an unethical thing. You got me wrong. I'm here to create space infrastructure. Help me. And we're meant to see or to think, I think, for the moment, oh, maybe Lorca's like not such a bad guy. You know, maybe she read him wrong. Maybe we read him wrong. There's actually a less sinister thing going on here. Now, we know from the end of the episode that that's not super true. Right after this scene, we're going to see him flip back to sinister mode, which will lead us to question the kindness in a way that we're seeing in the scene that we're talking about right now. But given that, I think we can rest pretty firmly on the fact that Lorca is not a good guy. What he's doing to Michael here is extremely manipulative at a deep emotional level, because he sees that she has a need to feel a little bit better about what she did, right? To have an excuse or reasoning for how maybe she isn't just this awful person that everyone keeps telling her that she is. She needs to hear that. And he's saying it to her. That is going to cause her, I think, to trust Lorca a little bit more, to be attached to Lorca a little bit more as the one person that maybe still sees good in her. And he's using that to manipulate her into being under his thumb. And I think that it's going to work a little because of how desperately she needs to feel that.
That's a really awesome observation, Valerie. And I think, you know, you and I have already been pointing out that we can see that some storyline is coming where someone is actually going to try to remove Lorca from his position or something to that effect when he does make a decision that is wholly unethical, that violates some law, in fact, perhaps the Geneva Conventions, perhaps something else. And I had been assuming, of course, that Saru and Burnham would sort of be on that side of things and Stamets. But actually, I think you're right here, Valerie, to point to the way that he's manipulating her, becoming really kind of inserting himself as the new Captain Georgiou for her. And of course, she feels so bad about the one time she did mutiny against her captain. She's never going to do it again. So she might be pitted up against Saru again at some point, which would be, I think that will be a very interesting moral dilemma to watch happen.
I think the succinct the succinct version of the very long thing that I just said is that he is preying on her vulnerability and using it to his advantage. And, you know, if I may draw a comparison to another nerdy thing, it kind of reminds me of the dynamic between the mayor and Faith in the Buffyverse, where Faith just needs someone to love her and care about how she's doing. And the mayor uses that to his advantage to manipulate her into doing his evil deeds. So there's like a little bit of the seeds of that, of Lorca pretending to care to prey on her vulnerability for his own agenda.
I want to point out something else here, Valerie, about this line, "Context is for kings," which, of course, is also the title of the episode. This, even before seeing the episode, reminded me of the fantastic TOS episode, "The Conscience of the King," which is a story about a war criminal who's gone into hiding, is attempting to live out his life anonymously to not be caught for his crimes and put on trial and punished for them. And I think we're meant to see that parallel here, because that we do have someone who is at least on the verge of doing something unethical, if not completely illegal, you know, and doing it in the context of war, justifying his actions by saying, we're at war, we have to do whatever it takes in order to defend ourselves. And I do want to point out there's one other interesting connection there, which is that in Conscience of the King, the inciting incident that led to the war crimes actually was something that involved fungus. And that's what we're seeing here as well.
And I think something interesting, too, we're meant to see about Lorca is, you know, a couple scenes ago, he shouted at someone, this isn't a democracy. I set the rules and you follow them. And here he is saying to Michael, you broke the rules. And sometimes that's the right decision. That means I like you even more. So Lorca's not a solid character. You can't trust what he's going to do or who he's going to like. He's volatile. I'm sure his allegiances change frequently. And I hope that we're meant to see, hey, no, following the rules is good. Please, because we're Starfleet and we have good rules that we're breaking completely with this entire ship and everything we're doing on it. But follow the rules.
I think that is going to be one of the themes of the show. So we don't actually get Burnham's decision here in this scene. We don't get that until the next scene where we find her unpacking in her quarters. And this is how we know that she has decided to stay. She talks with Tilly here about her copy of Alice in Wonderland, which her mother on Vulcan used to read to her and to Spock.
I actually didn't make the connection, which I clearly should have, but yeah, she has a human mother.
There's more to Burnham's story here than just that she used to read books with Spock. She explains that Alice in Wonderland subverts the standard hero's journey, right? That it plays with the rules of storytelling. It plays with the very rules of the world itself. And so I had to wonder, Valerie, is this the show's mission statement? Is this what the show is going to do?
I mean, it's already kind of done that, right? We have a very different lead character, a very different protagonist here than we're used to having. An anti-hero, right? Quite a few complicated anti-hero-esque characters. So that makes sense to me. But what I was really getting out of this scene was, again, a mention of her struggle between her humanness and her Vulcanness, in that she was trained in logic, and this was the book that showed her there was another way, that logic that only takes you so far. You know, she says something to that effect, like, you know, up sometimes is down, and Vulcan philosophy wouldn't really allow for that. So this was really important for her to connect with her humanity, but also what makes her more of a creative thinker as a character and balanced her out. And, you know, at first my reaction was like, oh, this is like a little heavy-handed to have all of these things about you be the result of this one book you used to read with your mom. But then I started thinking about all the things from my own childhood where when I saw that they worked that way, it opened to my mind to the fact that things could work that way and that those lessons have become a part of who I am and stuck with me. So in the end, it was a very touching scene.
And there's one more thing I want to point out about Alice in Wonderland here, Valerie, and that's this, that what we know of as the mirror universe, this sort of bizarro universe in which the Federation is evil, many of the episode titles where we see this in Deep Space Nine and in Enterprise actually take their episode titles from works by Lewis Carroll, from Alice in Wonderland stories. And so I do think that's being used here as a way to signal to us that although we're not in the mirror universe, probably, but that we are, that the writers know that they are writing a different Federation and a different Starfleet than we have seen before.
Okay, I appreciate that. I will say that as we reach the end of the discussion here, having talked this out with you and have heard some of these details and your perspective and, you know, thought through some of the things I was wrestling with this episode, I'm walking away with a little bit more of a positive view. I still feel like I'm craving the positivity and the utopian future that Star Trek typically offers me, and I'm not getting it here. But I've changed my mind a little bit on being frustrated with them creating a show that just didn't feel Star Trek-y enough to me. But now that I see maybe more of these subtle ways that they're continuing to tie things into the universe, I'm feeling better about that. Though I will say that I am still feeling sad that I don't think we're going to get a fun episodic Monster of the Week show out of this series. And I missed it. I kind of wanted that.
I miss it too, but this is just, that's not how TV works anymore, for the most part anyway. And so we are getting Star Trek that is for TV today. I think they're doing a good job with in telling a story in that mode. And I am, you know, I think part of the frustration that you're voicing here, Valerie, that I'm also not immune from, you know, comes from that, which is that we aren't getting standalone stories that are wrapped up. And so we're left kind of emotionally hanging on these sort of down notes because we're not seeing the full arc yet. And another thing I will say, too, is that because we're not getting these 45-minute morality plays each week, we are actually being shown a lot more than we're being told, which is something that you had pointed out in our last episode, that we are having to make a lot of inferences. But because we don't have Patrick Stewart or William Shatner telling us how we ought to live our lives, it doesn't feel in some ways like the show is actually doing that. But I do think it is showing us these conflicts and is inviting us to think about them. And I think that as we move deeper into our dramatic arc and towards the conclusion of it, we're going to get more and more of that. And it is in some ways, I think, going to be a mirror that we can look in and think about ourselves and think about our own society and certainly think about our own wars.
This is kind of a point I was making as I was thinking through it last night, which is that there are a lot of things I want Star Trek to be. One of them is the thing that you just mentioned. I want it to serve as a mirror to the current world and the problems of it. I want it to address heavy theme and conflicts and to help me think through problems in the world. And this show is doing that. But I also want Star Trek to, like I just said, be positive and fun and give me these fun little morality plays or, you know, see Deanna Troi get impregnated by a ball of light and be campy and fun. And I'm not getting that from this show. So I'm used to getting both, and I'm a little bit disappointed to only have half of it fulfilled right now. And I think that's where I'm sitting.
We're going to get an epilogue scene here, Valerie, that's going to actually point to some other storytelling possibilities here on Star Trek Discovery. And this last scene is this. Lorca is hanging out in a science lab with a lot of alien skeletons. And we learn here that he's had Commander Landry beam over the monster from the USS Glenn, and that he's very, very interested in it. And so this really points to what you were talking about earlier, Valerie, which is that he has a lot of science experiments going on board this ship, and that we might see these as maybe as actually in some ways Monster of the Week episodes where we see some of the negative or unintended consequences of some of these experiments wreaking havoc on the Discovery or through the Discovery in some way. And I'll be interested to see how this plays out.
And I don't know if you caught this. It was one of the first things I saw in that scene, but behind him in the scary monster lab, when we first see him there, is a skeleton. Did you catch what that's a skeleton of?
So I thought it might actually have been a Klingon. What did you think it was?
No, it's Gorn.
Oh, cool. Yes, of course it is. Absolutely. Oh, that's a great catch. Great catch. That's exciting.
Yeah. It's Gorn. And Gorn, of course, is this pretty well known because of like how good / bad the makeup, the costume of this character is. But Gorn is a, a lizard alien that we first see in the original series episode Arena. It was a Gorn skeleton behind him. I thought that was really fun.
That's awesome. I'm gonna go back and look at that right now and see if I can make any just for my own amusement. I think that's a really awesome catch.
So Glenn, I hope now that I pointed out that there's a Gorn skeleton there, this might be part of your answer to the question I'm about to ask you. But it is your turn to play Smooch, Marry, Kill. And I will also warn you to be very careful about who you pick, because the three people that I picked in our pilot episode all died in the very next episode. So I have the Smooch, Marry, Kill of death that I carry with me. Tread carefully, Glenn.
I am glad you have brought up this Gorn skeleton, because there aren't a lot of options so far. We certainly have not gotten very well introduced to all of our characters yet. We've focused on only a few characters. I'll point out, for example, we haven't met a doctor yet. We know Kayla is here, but we haven't really spoken to her yet. Hopefully we'll get some of her in the next episode. So I, like you, Valerie, I started with the smooching. I think this is the easier choice. And I think it will not surprise you at all that I have chosen Commander Landry to smooch.
Oh, of course you did.
She is serious business. She is very intense. And I think that makes her a pretty good candidate for smooching. But she does not seem like a fun person. She's certainly not the sort of person I want to spend the rest of my life with.
Actually, I want to know who you're going to kill next.
I have to say that right now, the person that I want to get rid of, the person who I found to be an annoying presence on screen, is Lieutenant Stamets. He is so angry and bigoted that I just didn't want to hear it. But I had, this was a tough choice for me between Stamets and Captain Lorca. And I decided ultimately that I preferred Captain Lorca's menacing and sinisterness and fortune cookies to Stamets's angry bigotry.
Yeah, I mean, Stamets's bigotry doesn't even come with cookies. Good point.
That's right. If you got cookies, I'll let you live. That's basically the moral of the story here.
All right. If you ever find yourself in a fight with Glenn, bring cookies. All right. So then I guess, more importantly, who are you going to marry?
This, again, here is a tough choice. And to me, there are two people on board the ship who seem, one, like they would be caring individuals that you might actually want to spend the rest of your life with, and who also might also be interesting people to have a relationship with, someone you can engage with. And the people I was considering here are our First Officer Saru and Cadet Sylvia Tilly. So ultimately, I decided that for me, the rubric I was going to use to make this choice was their response to situations of involving fear. And Saru is someone who is very much afraid and is hesitant when faced with a frightening choice or in a tense situation. Whereas you pointed out, Valerie, Tilly almost becomes a new person in a stressful situation, when there's someone who needs to take charge of a situation and be bold in the face of danger, she really steps up. And as someone who has some dangerous hobby in mountaineering, that's the person I want with me on my life journey.
Aw, I think that was a good pick. Those were all great and thoughtful answers. Thank you for sharing. I look forward to seeing whether or not they make it to more episodes.
Yeah, well, now that we've figured out who I'm going to marry and possibly all of the characters who are going to die in the next episode, I think that's going to do it for our coverage today. But we'll be back next week. And until then, I'm Glenn McDormand.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland. And as always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com.
Yeah, come on over to the Clay Temple forums and give us your thoughts about this episode. I know, as we've said, in particular, we're really interested in having some of the science clarified for us. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about Stamets's role in this ongoing conversation about race and culture as well.
And until then, stay spacey.